Informed and unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Big Picture on this glorious Wednesday evening. I'm Joseph Himsworth, and I will be your host for today's programme, offering up a veritable platter of interesting and newsworthy topics for our insightful panel to gorge upon. They are...
Maddie Hale.
And Lizzie Jurgen.
And I'm Samuel Shee-Smith.
And I'm Ben Longan.
Hi, I'm Luke Chignall.
Jolly good. Right. Foreign affairs have taken a significant role in the news over the past week or so. So first to Ukraine, as I'm sure you're all aware. What are you all giggling at? Ukraine has been ablaze with riots and protests, but has slowly been, but surely evolved into what looks like full-blown Armageddon. Protesters have torn apart and littered once beautiful streets, whilst the authorities have reacted aggressively, in some cases firing upon citizens. The country's political elite have one by one fled. The former president, Yanukovych, Mayor Kurnes and Governor Dobkin have all left the country. So my first question to our panel, the country's political elite have one by one... with such chaos and dismay, does this represent the breakdown of Ukraine? Is there any coming back from these dramatic events?
I just want to say I'm totally shocked by what's happened and to the magnitude, to the scale that Ukraine has taken this protest on. I think at a time when they want close, the general population want closer ties with the European Union, to cause such shocking protests just baffles me. So these protests were, from my knowledge, caused by the fact that Russia or the leadership within the Ukraine wanting to move closer to Russia. So I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure.
Ladies.
I think it kind of, this depends on what the international response to all these war crimes is, honestly. I think it's currently, there's currently an investigation going on, obviously. There's currently an investigation going on, so it kind of depends, like, the Ukrainian security agency is going to be publishing documents on what's going on, and then they can kind of, I don't know, hone it back to Ukraine after. I think it depends on what happens on an international level.
I'm fairly certain they'll come back for this. It's hard for it to destabilise a country. I say that, I've never destabilised a country. But Ukraine, it's the inevitable outcome of a very heavily influenced by Russia, Eastern European country. This tends to happen a lot.
So you don't think there's any risk of fractions developing within the country, any split up? So we have an example: the Prime Minister of Crimea declared recognition of the provisional government in Kiev, which has just come in, given that their current leader has fled. In sharp contrast to that, at the Congress of the Southern Eastern Regions, deputies have rejected the authority of Parliament. So with that in mind, do you not think there's any possibility of a great breakup of the country as a whole?
I don't think there'll be a split right down the middle, because I feel that a stage where that would be imminent, although, you know, the fact that there has been this outright sort of turn down upon the government, the fact that that has existed, perhaps... is a symbol that it is imminent, but in the true eyes of the international police, I'm saying that in inverted commas, America, if in their eyes, Ukraine was about to split, I think that someone would step in. So whether that be America or some body within Europe or even the UK, I think someone would just step in, or Russia even. I don't think it would be allowed to happen.
As I see it, Ukraine's kind of divided between the pro-European, Ukrainian-speaking ethnic Ukrainians in the West and the pro-Russian, Russian-speaking ethnic Russians in the East, in a sense, in like very basic terms. I think if it, it remained a single country after the fall of the Soviet Union, so, I mean, that was a pretty big occasion. I think it will probably stay a country now.
True.
If it will stay after that, then...
That was quite an event of magnitude,
yeah,
the whole
definitely.
Collapse. So if
it can survive that.
I think Maddie's got the crux of this issue here, and that's that Ukraine is a strong nation. You know, the fact that the people are willing to stand up to the government in this way, it's obviously an extremely tragic situation that's happening over there. But I think Ukraine has stayed strong before through some very troubling times, and I think it will continue to do so through these.
Thank you. Now, Russia clearly has huge interests in the in the country. As mentioned, the Soviet Union before, great territorial interests there. And on the 20th of this month, Colonel of the Main Intelligence Directorate in Russia stated that the conflict could only be solved by force and that Ukraine could not exist as an independent sovereign nation. In addition to that, a political advisor in Russia stated that they would do everything possible to stop the opposition in Ukraine coming to power. So with this in mind, do the panel think that Russia has been restrained or perhaps aggressive? And what do they think the next step of Russia will be with regards to Ukraine?
I think that especially at a time when the Sochi Olympics as they're happening and have just recently happened, I think as the media attention is focusing on Russia, they've got to be extremely vigilant and extremely careful about what they're going to do in terms of Ukraine's situation.
I mean, I thought it was very a slightly tangent. I don't know if anyone noticed obviously in the opening ceremony, there was that one ring that didn't open. Yep. It's kind of a bit of a like meme on the internet as well. And in the closing ceremony, a kind of un-Russian move, they really laughed at themselves and they made sure one of them didn't open and they made it like a bit of a bit. And I think it was quite good of them to kind of laugh at themselves a bit. And I think it's a sign that they're very aware that the world is looking at them because of the Olympics and stuff. And they don't want to be too kind of out there and violent, really.
Thank you for that. Now, we have a text that's coming, ladies and gentlemen. This individual says, "Why are you all so Westphalian? Why do we even need countries? Let them split, be happy. Eventually, there will be no countries because they just cause hate, violence, and war." Thank you for that.
Really interesting, that text, because for me, that's the opposite of what splitting countries will. So to me, countries, if they were to split, it makes more possibilities for conflict to occur. So, going right back to the Roman Empire, to build the empire, to make everyone one culture, one, and an attempt to do so, tried to push away from the war, though maybe using the Romans as an example isn't the best idea, because then the Romans caused the war with everyone else. But for me to have these countries, then so in the case of Ukraine, if it did split, it's causing more of a difference, and I think that then can potentially lead to war.
So with that idea in mind, saying that if countries separate up and split up, there's more of a likelihood of war. With that in mind, do you think the logical conclusion is for the Ukraine to have greater ties with Russia, even though it's quite an authoritarian state?
I don't, because of the fact that it does, you can comfortably say it is an authoritarian state. Because of that fact, I think that Ukraine will pull towards the European Union. I think that's in the political elite's interest within Ukraine, and also the leaders of the European Union, their interest to get Ukraine on board. Because at the end of the day, the EU, I imagine, just wants to expand. But I'm a Eurosceptic, so that's
Well, no, I agree. I think it's definitely in Ukraine's best interest to lean towards the European Union, just because it's a lot more, I say, secure. There's a lot of kind of controversy, and there's a lot of kind of question marks around Russia and Russia's politics, just as like a general thing. Not nothing like actually negative, it's Russia, but there is always that. And European Union is, I know it's awfully like bureaucratic and stuff, but it does have its awfully bureaucratic. But it does have its benefits. I think it's a lot more of a safe, sort of secure place for a country to be a part of.
Do you think? Sorry, you were going to say.
Yeah, I was going to say. Basically, Ukraine's got the split between lesser of two evils, either European Union, which seems safer but a bit bogged down in bureaucracy, and generally at the beck and call of Germany, and Russia, which historically has not been particularly friendly to its satellite states. But I'd say that, the people will want to become more westernized as a general rule. That's what the whole crisis is about in Ukraine. So I think the inevitable outcome will be further ties to the European Union.
Mm-hmm, so do you think that with that idea in mind and the idea of something of a dichotomy between the West in the form of the European Union and perhaps the United States and also Russia, do you think in a sense there's something of a Cold War sort of esqueness about this?
There's certainly parallels. I mean, it's almost like it's the 70s again.
Yeah.
But with the benefit of a far more transparent world now with the internet and social media, which plays a part that the Cold War did not have.
And I think the important thing is that we do understand at the moment this is an argument, a battle, I suppose, between the two factions of the East and the West that the people of Ukraine are ultimately paying the price for. So I think it's important that people do remember that Ukraine is the innocent victim of what is a tug of war going on here between the East and the West. And I think that the sooner that comes to an end, clearly the more stable and better the world will be.
So do you think, you mentioned a tug of war, do you think that there's blame to be put on both parties in the form of Russia and the EU for sort of playing this game with this country?
I don't think it can be regarded solely from a top-down approach. So there are these superpowers. I say, you know, use that really lightly. I don't think it's a case of these two enormous bodies that are trying to have dealings with the country. I think it's more of the country wants to decide which direction to go into.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's necessarily a one-directional kind of thing.
Now, it's of course hugely unwise to generalise, but does the panel foresee such violence and unrest that we're seeing currently in Ukraine? Do you foresee that spreading? Do you see the events in Ukraine spreading to be almost like an Arab Spring across the east of Europe? Or do you think that it's purely an isolated incident to do simply with internal party politics?
Personally, I think it's more internal party politics. I don't think it's quite the Arab Spring where it's going to be the fall of dictator of dictator, because Europe doesn't really have that situation. We're not all in the same...
Well, maybe it does have dictators in the EU.
Sorry.
I don't think it's going to be quite another Arab Spring, because I don't think it has the kind of setup and that kind of mentality that they have.
I disagree somewhat. I'd say that all the Eastern European countries, and this is a massive generalisation, I'm probably going to get killed in the text, that most Eastern European countries are struggling against Russia's influence and the EU's influence. All that whole kind of like land mass between sort of east of Germany as a sort of after, you know, the Cold War and the reunification of Germany, that whole kind of area to the east has always been a kind of tug of war of ideologies. And I think this fight in Ukraine will not necessarily spark further protests in other countries, but will certainly add to the kindling.
Well,
yeah, I see.
I'm sure that whatever happens in Ukraine, this show and of course the world will keep a keen eye on it. So thank you for the panel for those insightful engagements. Now, moving away from foreign affairs to events closer to home. As I'm sure you're all aware, everyone's favourite newspaper, the Daily Mail, has embarked on another vitriolic rampage against a leading politician. Last time the Mail found itself in combat with the leader of the Labour Party and Wallace lookalike Ed Miliband. This time, however, Labour's deputy leader Harriet Harman is in the firing line. On the 24th of this month, Harman denied allegations that she had supported the paedophilia information exchange when the advocacy group was affiliated with the National Council for Civil Liberties, while she was the latter's legal officer. The Mail has claimed that Harman's partner, Jack Dromney MP, and former Health Secretary Patricia Hewitt were apologists for the abuse of children whilst working at the NCCL. Both the Mail and the Telegraph have urged Ed Miliband to address the issue as a matter of urgency. So, to our first question, does this represent a national scandal for Harriet Harman and the Labour Party?
Before I start, hello, I'm Elliot. Sorry I'm late. It's because of the stupid Nottingham City Council, their stupid workplace parking levy, and their stupid tram work. So don't vote for Labour next time.
Nobody cares, and the parking levy probably didn't affect your journey in here. What's your point?
It did. My point is now Harriet Harman. National scandal. Yes, this is. I mean, how can a person of this sort of regard, who was the legal expert for this group, actually support groups, affiliated groups such as this, or have implied support for groups like this without suffering any sort of disrespect from the general public? It actually amazes me. And I think the main reason why Harriet Harman did this was because, let's be fair to Harriet Harman, although she probably has some weird lefty views, I don't think supporting paedophilia is one of them. What it is that she decided to
be a careerist. Her career was to, right, I'm going to be an MP in 10 years, but I've got to do all this legal work for the lefty charity organisations and things like that. And so when she decided to bite the bullet to support these sorts of people, implicitly support these people, and then she would become an MP. So this just proves that Harriet Harman is a careerist who should not be trusted.
Well, that's an interesting picture you're painting, Elliot, but I fear it's far from the truth. The reality, as Harriet Harman explained on the exclusive Newsnight interview, which was there was thousands of groups which were technically affiliated to this civil liberties group. They only had to do was pay their affiliation, and there was no vetting procedure for that group. Therefore, if there was any problem with that, it was that the fact that the organisation failed to have any vetting procedure. But the idea that Harriet Harman specifically endorsed explicitly or implicitly the paedophile information exchange because it was simply paid £6 to this group, which was one of thousands of groups to do so, to the organisation she worked for, and to call it a massive national scandal and claim that somehow she's endorsing paedophilia, I think is a smear campaign.
I think if we're there to take the words of Harriet Harman and Jack Dromey MP, and just as a reminder, Jack Dromey MP is a person who's won several all-women shortlists in trade unions, I think we can't take these people's words. They're moral hypocrites there. But if we were to take these people's words, why was it that anybody could become affiliated to this thing? Isn't there clearly a problem then with this group that she was a member of, that she knew, being a legal expert for it, that anybody could become affiliated? Surely she thought that would be a problem, that there'd be some moral problems with having groups, which I'm sure that if the Mail will do lots more digging, find lots more affiliated groups, which would be cause. Surely she didn't realise that that would be a problem. I think she should be more careful, and she should have been more careful back in the 70s and 80s when she was working there.
I think that's how we've got to draw the distinction, because there is a difference between some of the allegations or even some of the people who will still read them. It is clear that Harriet Harman is not a paedophile. It is clear that Jack Dromey is not a paedophile. There is still some ridiculous element. I don't think anybody genuinely believes that. But there is still some kind of suggestion that's the case. I think, to be honest, what Elliot said towards the end there, the worst charge you can put against them is the fact that they were part of a group that clearly carelessly accepted people within their membership, and that is something for which they should be criticised. But should they be criticised to the extent, should this be a national scandal, inverted commas? No, it's not that serious as to warrant that, when you consider there's still quite a several degrees of separation between that paedophile group and or between that group and the politicians mentioned.
I'd agree, yes, it is a problem and perhaps careless to have, and a mistake to have, a group where you can simply pay your affiliation with no vetting and then call yourselves affiliated to the group. That was a mistake. However, you've got to question, even if she was the legal advisor, the extent to which Harriet Harman has the power, would have had the power to change that. And ultimately, you've got to weigh up the benefits that the group does despite that with the rest of it. Now, I don't know too much about the group as a whole then, but anyway, nowadays it's a liberty and does quite a lot of good work. So perhaps, you know, it was worth at the time thinking there may be some problems with unvetted groups getting affiliation, but I can do more good working for this organisation than simply walking away because you fear there may be an upcoming problem.
You know, as I said, Seb and Luke's views are taking the words biblically. What am I trying to say? They're taking the words absolutely on the side of Harriet Harman and Jack Dromey, taking what they say absolutely as truth. And you know, as on the text here, we've got a member of the Labour Party saying, it does worry me. It smacks of, you know, impossibility that they could not known that there would be some sort of scandal, maybe not this direct group but others. And also, I think to wash Harriet Harman of any blame here and saying, being a legal advisor and actually pretty key in this pretty key in this organisation, she should have known that these things would have caused controversy.
Why didn't they cause controversy at the time?
Because people weren't doing the digging into it. There's lots of things that don't cause controversy at the time, but when you look down to it, you do. Now, clearly, the Daily Mail has some sort of thing to go and get Harriet Harman.
So,
and clearly
how many other national scandals are going to come up from all this digging?
I think there might be a few more. You're absolutely right.
I was going to say that you're sort of creating a dichotomy here between, you know, in party politics terms, between Labour and Tory. Do you not think there may be Tory individuals?
Well, I'm not sure with that particular group, but there are probably going to be things which have happened which Tory MPs have done. Of course they're going to be. I'm not being party political here at all. I'm saying that these things will come back to haunt MPs, and the more people do digging on materials that they have done in the past.
Well, I mean, it's all well and good going back and digging into all these people's backgrounds. And yeah, we should be very aware of who we are, of who is representing us in Parliament and who is representing us on like a national and global scale. But in the end, and this is not to diminish what she's done at all, but I think, I don't know, in a way, it's kind of more, I'm more on the side that, yeah, you've cocked up in the past and yeah, you're in an important position. But it's more about what I think she's spending a lot of time now dealing with all the scandal stuff when she could be dealing with a lot more important issues that are actually going on now. They're not in the past. They're not back scandals. What can we do looking forward to, A, stop this kind of thing happening? Are we going to look into everyone's backgrounds? And what can we do to actually move on from this? Is it like legislation that needs to happen? Is there need to be better betting? What can we move on? We need
absolutely
to look forward.
I agree that as long as people like us, I suppose, on this show are talking about these issues, we're not actually talking about the real issues. And as long as the Daily Mail is dedicating its front page to this, it's not dedicating to the fact that there are genuine problems out that we can make a difference about. Do I think that the fact that Harriet Harman was part of a group that was affiliated to a paedophile network was bad? Yes, I do think that's bad. Do I think actually there's much relevance in that fact in the 21st century? No, I don't. Yes, we can talk about it. Yes, we can make it clear. Yes, we can condemn it. But I think actually the longer that we try and drag it out, there's absolutely no reason to drag it out other than trying to keep the mud sticking. And I think only the politics, the party political side of it will benefit from that.
Now, we have a text in, ladies and gentlemen, and that says that this is an unbalanced argument from a clearly pro-Tory bench. Hello.
Rubbish.
This debate has been provoked by the Daily Mail in capital letters, a clear smear campaign. Why don't you debate things that need, again in capital letters, debating rather than the distraction in capital letters? Those capital letters are very reminiscent of Daily Mail letters, it must be said.
I don't know if this texter has heard the full argument. I mean, I know Elliot's quite loud, but it's clear that it is Elliot. And Elliot has been the only one that I've heard really so far who has firmly said that this is an important issue. In fact, I hadn't seen that text before I just made my previous comment. But as Maddie mentioned, yeah, that's half the panel. We've said, yes, there are more important things than this. And obviously, we debate on this show what is in the news, and this is in the news, but it shouldn't really be in the news to the extent that it is. So I think it's to if they're calling this particular panel a pro-Tory bench making an unbalanced argument, I think that's a bit of a false criticism.
I think, yeah, ultimately, I think, although you'd say that Daily Mail is more conservative than Labour, I think it's unfair to say this is a Tory thing. It is really a Daily Mail thing. The same Daily Mail that said Ralph Miliband hated Britain is clearly out to do pretty flaky stories attacking the Labour front bench. So, Ed Bulls, clearly get your Daily Mail attack team ready for whenever they may come for you. But as for the smear camp, so I'm trying to read over the text again as I say this, but it's been provoked by Daily Mail, and it is a smear campaign. But again, as for the debating things that need debating, we do, on the big picture, debate issues of substance almost always.
Indeed,
but
yeah.
When these issues do make the front pages, we feel it's important to, you know, cover the issues that people are hearing about and that a lot of people need informing, and, you know, clear the smear away from people's eyes, to mix strange analogies.
Yeah, indeed. Now, Harman expressed regret, she said, for Liberty's involvement with a paedophilia campaign run by the PIE. So is this response enough? I know we've covered this a little. Or do you think there's perhaps more grovelling to come?
I don't know. I think it's one. Yeah, she did say she's sorry. And I think, well, as I was saying earlier and what Luke was saying, there are definitely more important issues than this that are going on right now. I'm sure a lot of people say, oh, she must grovel, she must do all of these things and apologise profusely. But what good will that do? Once she's got her point across, people need to just move on and start looking to what's really going on, like, behind the scenes. I mean, it's all well and good looking and focusing at this, but this is just a massive distraction. There might be something absolutely huge going on behind the scenes that everyone is oblivious to because we're all looking away at this wonderful scandal that British people love to look at from the Daily Mail.
I don't think, however, Harriet Harman dealt with this, there would be people like Elliot who would be happy with it, to be honest. And as I'm certainly not coming from the Harriet Harman sympathy camp, but I am coming from the let's be realistic and practical about what makes a difference in the world today. And actually, I don't think that constant debate of this issue is really going to affect that. Which means that whether or not she expresses regret, whatever she says about it, there will always be people who will continue keep throwing this at her. And as I say, I don't have a concern because I think that she's done wrong to be affiliated with that organisation in the first place. But as long as we are doing that, we are distracting ourselves from other issues. And that's the main problem with this.
You know, Harriet Harman for the longevity of this story, bears a lot of responsibility on it herself. Because, you know, we're finally eking out an apology. She said she regrets. But the Mail won't stop until Harriet Harman, you know, says, I'm absolutely sorry, it shouldn't have happened. And, you know, I'm absolutely unapologetic. Because, you know,
at which point they will expect her to resign. Because, yeah, you know, well, that's how they're pushing her. If they push her into making, if they push her into admitting that she has made a decision that is so bad in the past and so absolutely horrendous, then they will say yes. If you've been that bad, then you should resign now for it. That's what they want.
Now, Elliot,
right, it's unrealistic of the media. Media has whenever they produce things, and yes, it is a smear campaign. It's clearly not, as we've said, as I've said, this is not the most pressing issue of the day. But the fact that Harriet Harman has refused to apologise and refused to do it for so long has actually put this question into the longevity. And actually, I think if Harriet Harman had said right at the end, right at the beginning of this thing, you know, I'm absolutely sorry, wouldn't happen again, there wouldn't be another Daily Mail front page story, there wouldn't be another thing, the Daily Mail would just accept that. And although she would have
the Daily Mail are known for accepting things as soon as
it's ridiculous. The media are known for things. You are a hateful man.
We've got a very interesting text here. Now, it's clearly from the person who texted us before, and he or she says, it's not Elliot, whoever that is.
Sorry, to clarify, that's possibly because I maybe indicated that he was Elliot. I was actually indicating that our panellist, Elliot, was the only person who was coming from that point of view. So, for any ambiguity.
So it says, it's not Elliot, whoever that is. An 85-year-old Catholic priest being convicted of paedophilia activities over many years is big news, capital letters again. I take back the pro-Tory thing. I'm listening and writing as it goes along. And I am a hypocrite. I do read the Daily Mail when I am bored because it is entertaining dribble. So thank you for clarifying, sir or madam. Now, our last question on this topic concerns the Labour Party itself. Now, we talked about Harriet Harman and her response. What's the Labour Party? What's Ed Miliband going to do about this? Will there be any major response?
I think it shouldn't be any major response. I think most of us on the panel have said that it's not too great a thing. And I think there's nothing really more Ed Miliband can or should do. I think, briefly going back to the previous question, I think the statement of regret was more a statement of regret, well, partly that she was involved, but partly that it has been such a fury about the issue at all, which I don't think really is that justified. Therefore, I think any action by Ed Miliband would be an overreaction, and I can't really see any appropriate response Ed Miliband could give to it that would do anything to help the situation.
Yeah, this is a personal thing, and it wasn't Harriet Harman as a representative of the Labour Party joining or anything. This was Harriet Harman individually, and I think it's Harriet Harman individually and the others involved, like Jack Dramey, who need to deal with this individually. If Labour now try and get involved, that would be an absolutely ridiculous decision from their part. They want to stay as far away from it as they can.
Yeah, absolutely right. They want to stay as far away as possible. But, you know, even if the Labour Party did want to get involved, they couldn't. Harriet Harman is the only constant in the Labour Party at the moment. When the Labour Party left office in 2010, she was the only person who was still left from the government in her own role. She never got re-elected to that own role. She's still the deputy leader of the Labour Party, and she will continue to be. And, you know, she's probably one of the main people running the shop when it comes to the Labour Party. Not necessarily the Labour Party policy, or the Ed Miliband at PMQs, but she is the one person who's driving forward the leftwardness of the Labour Party.
All of our topics today have been rather serious. We've had violence and riots in Ukraine and paedophilia with Harriet Harman. So to finish off, let's end on something a little more lighthearted. Everyone's favourite beer-swigging and fag-puffing politician Nigel Farage has accepted a debate with the leader of the Liberal Democrats and, well, Seb's favourite politician, Nick Clegg. Farage was admittedly very slow to respond to Clegg's proposal, but eventually accepted, remarking how he almost choked on his bacon butty when he had heard of the offer. So, our question today is, why has this been offered? Is it Nick Clegg's attempt to ensure that his party does not sink further below UKIP in the national rankings? Or is it simply that the Lib Dems like the European Union and want to ensure Britain's continued participation in the face of UKIP's Euroscepticism?
I think it's a mixture of both the reasons you just said. I think partly I think it probably will be beneficial because Lib Dems are the only party who are unashamedly pro-in and party of in, and so this very clearly displays to those who are in favour of the EU and staying in the EU and the British electorate that they should vote for the Lib Dems if they want to stay in the EU. But there's also the pattern, you know, the issues and really believing it and believing in the issues. Too many European elections beforehand have really focused just on Westminster politics and haven't really included a debate about the EU. So this will be the first one in a long time which will really be not quite a referendum on the EU, as Elliot will no longer use his hashtag let Britain decide in a second, which he always does. But it will certainly actually be about the EU. And I think it's about time that there is more of a debate on the benefits of the EU, because I think for an awfully long time there's been a false consensus, as with immigration in mainstream British politics, because too many parties being scared to take the benefit, put the benefits forward in case it hurts them politically.
Well, Seb's opened up a huge kettle of fish about the EU there, an EU debate, which I'm not going to get into. I want to talk about Nick Clegg. Is this going to help Nick Clegg for the Euro elections? It will help Nick Clegg, because what he's going after is he's going after, as Seb has said, the inners, the people who want to remain in Europe. And if he can win more of those votes who might go to Labour, he might do better. But it's a stupid decision because he's going to show himself up. He's not as good a debater as Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage is one of the most charismatic politicians in Britain at the moment. And if it's going to be a national TV debate, a large number of people are going to watch it, and they're going to decide on the Europe elections. It's going to lead to more people voting UKIP, and it's going to leave Nick Clegg looking stupid. And although that in the short term will get him more votes because he will show, you know, I'm solidarity with the inners, when it comes to the general election, he's just going to be laughed off the street because he'll be humiliated on national television. It's a stupid decision by Clegg overall.
I think it's a question of asking who this really works for. Does it work for Farage? Yes, because it gives him a chance to spout a lot of stuff that people, without challenging it, will probably quite like to hear over the TVs. Obviously, for Clegg there, it gives him an opportunity to, I think, as Elliot said, to appease the people that he's looking to get out the vote, as it were, and to make it clear that the Liberal Democrats are the party for Europe. But for, I suppose, standard Eurosceptics who don't fall fully into Farage's camp, I don't think Clegg is the sort of person that's going to try and win them round. In fact, I think Clegg is going to push them further away, partly because of Clegg not being a great debater, but also partly because I think it needs to be... What Clegg? Sorry, Gina, I've completely missed my point there. I thought I heard. Partly because Clegg is not the sort of person that's going to bring those kind of people into the fold. He's not going to appeal to a middle ground in any way. It's going to be a case of just polarising the debate even more from those who want to be in, those who want to be out. And actually, if it was somebody like Cameron who was providing a moderate alternative and not just waving the European Union flag, then I think that would be a lot more beneficial as far as the Eurosceptic movement more broadly goes.
So, does this offer of a debate represent a significant step for UKIP towards political maturity, do you think?
I think it will help. I don't think there is always a problem with UKIP. They can't last as a party because of their demographics, because most of their members are actually over 70, and sadly, they will be passing away sometime in the future. It's the honest truth. The honest truth is that UKIP cannot survive as a political party because they don't have the continuing demographics. But, you know, do they reach political maturity for the Euro elections? Most definitely. For the general election, maybe. It might do some... It will certainly help them. It won't give them a disadvantage. But, you know, I just, as I say again, the main problem with this as well, actually, is we're going to have a third and a fourth party debate for the Euro elections. Why not then just have a first and a second party debate for the general election? That's going to hurt Clegg, and that's also going to hurt Farage. So actually, in the long run, it's probably better for Labour and the Conservatives. Whether they agree to having a one or two debate is, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But if there was a one-on-two debate between Ed Miliband and David Cameron, they would do better in the general election.
Can I go back to one of your earlier points about the elder generation? It's actually, old people do turn out and vote, probably more so than young people.
Young people are wonderful.
Yeah, they're very good at turning out. They get together in their when they play bowls and whatever old people do, knitting and things. A knitting club they discuss going out to vote.
I don't think
we're winning over many old voters.
Yeah, they like have a turnout. And to be honest, I think UKIP quite like being, not the underdog, that's the wrong word, but I think they don't want to reach maturity. They don't want to be like a big party. I think they quite enjoy being the little party on the side that gets the debate going, kind of pokes people into talking about stuff and gets things on kind of a national level. I don't think they really want, I don't know, I'm not obviously a member of UKIP, but I think they just quite like being the little party on the side that likes being talked about.
And it benefits them. It's the same point that I've made loads of times on the show before, which is that from UKIP's point of view, it's not about actually following through views or anything. Actually, it's about tapping into that little bit of, I dare say, exists in everyone, that here's something that winds them up and they think, right, I want to do something about this.
Oh, they love that. People love that.
Well, they do. And without a real chance to challenge it, which Clegg won't have, because we're going to be talking about loads of issues crammed into probably a one-hour debate. Those 60 minutes are not going to be enough to change the years and years of negative press that the EU's got. And I can see Elliot's upset again that I seem to be moving over to the left a little bit more, but it is true, you know, that there is within the Express and the Mail in particular, there is a lot of anti-EU sentiment, and to battle and combat that, 60 minutes is not going to be enough for Clegg to do. So actually he is going to push the people further away. Farage is going to have the point to get his sound bites out there, which is enough to benefit people, and I think that will be it.
Yeah, I think as the political maturity point, I think it will help achieve some political maturity, yes. I don't think it'll, you know, change the fact, you know, they're already, well, outside the mainstream in some respects ideologically in the way they position themselves, but very much in terms of their size, you know, they are a significant party in terms of what they're polling. Probably won't translate into great results in the general election, will in the European election. So it's not going to gain that much support, and it may be good overall to see some of these points challenged, which don't often happen sometimes in the national press. As for a very earlier point about whether David Cameron will be better to do that, I disagree. I think David Cameron, certainly pressure from his backbenchers, would be under pressure to be almost as Eurosceptic as Nigel Farage, and I certainly don't think he could make much of a pro-EU point. Otherwise, I think his backbenchers would probably kill him immediately afterwards. So I think certainly it's more an issue if Nick Clegg versus Nigel Farage is more unambiguously pro-Europe and unambiguously anti-Europe, and really best demonstrates those two points, whereas Labour and Conservatives have much less clear messages on the subject.
Well, we've got another text in, and it says it should be Ken Clark versus Nigel Farage instead. Clearly a more interesting battle between two people happy to say what they think. Now, on to my next sort of little question. So after this debate, does the panel think it is likely that Farage will be included in the leadership debates, if they happen, televised, for the general election next year?
No, not at all. And if people bow down to that, and it's ridiculous. He's got no MPs. You know, Caroline Lucas's Green Party has more MPs than Nigel Farage's. He's not the sort of fourth party that he wants to come across as being. He's actually one of a number of minor parties that people across the spectrum agree with to one extent or another. You know, as I say, the Green Party have more MPs. Should we include the Green Party? No, because actually it should be a question of a debate between those people who are going to be able to lead the government, not just between those people who want to get their policy out there. Farage is never going to run a government. Caroline Lucas is never going to run a government. These minor parties are never going to run a government. To that extent, you could say that having Clegg in there is unnecessary as well. I don't know, possibly. I think Clegg's clearly, as he's shown, got the power, and I say power in inverted commas, to influence what happens in government at higher level. So maybe he should be there with the prospect of a coalition quite high as well. But no, outside of those three, certainly, there's no justification for having anyone else.
I don't think Nick Clegg will get included now. And as I've said, you know, he's already having his own Wendy House politics debate with Nigel Farage over Europe. So why should he get included? You know, he's corned himself out of the market very stupidly, actually. And, you know, actually, we're in a country where we're here to decide who's going to be leading the government, essentially, with leadership debates. And Nick Clegg is never going to lead the government, even if, you know... even if Labour and the Conservatives got an equal amount of seats and weren't able to form a government either way, you know, Nick Clegg would not be in charge. Nick Clegg would be some sort of sideman. You know, Nick Clegg bigs up his role in government. He does nothing. He sits around all day looking for jobs to do, according to parliamentary staff. You know, and it's ridiculous. And also, I think the fact, recent fact, that both David Cameron now and Len McCluskey are saying that in the Labour and the Conservative manifesto, it's very likely that there will be a clause saying we are not going into coalition with Nick Clegg ever. You know, it's going to be curtains for Cleggers.
I think kind of going back to the original question about kind of who's going to be involved in the leadership debates, I think putting UKIP and stuff in that kind of league, kind of, I don't know, I don't know how to put it right, it's kind of appreciating something that not the majority of the people agree with. They're never going to be in a position of leadership, personally, I don't think. And the only reason that they'd ever be considered for it is because they shout the loudest on certain events. They get people talking. But in that same vein, the Monster Raving Loony Party sometimes get people talking and they have hilarious debates. But it doesn't mean that they're ever going to stand any chance of actually being in any kind of power. In the same sense that in America, there was, I don't know if anyone else watched back in the last election, there was a man with a Wellington boot on his head. And it was all fun and games watching him in these debates, like the very kind of early stage debates and things. But it didn't really add anything. If anything, it just distracted people from the real issues and people that are genuinely in, like, condition to be in a leadership place.
So last and final question, and very brief from all of you. If there is to be a sort of victor in this debate, who do you think it will be?
What do you mean? Like, out of...
Well, who do you think will come out on top?
Out of UKIP?
Out of Nigel Farage and Nick Clegg.
Oh, it depends who shouts the loudest.
Right.
Farage is just so much better at debating.
Farage, in terms of polling, because British people are still predominantly Eurosceptic, but there'll be a good benefit for the Lib Dems, and it's still a good decision on the Lib Dems to go into the debate.
I'll tell you who won't win. The moderate Eurosceptic movement that wants to actually put its case forward and not in the way, not through the mouth of somebody who is simply going to try and fly the European flag there. They're the people that are going to really lose out because of this. Don't know who'll win, but they're going to lose.
Thank you all. Very interesting.